court is ready to hear argument in 050748, Southwestern Bell Telephone Company versus Marketing on Hold, Inc., doing business as Southwest Tariff Analyst.
Please, the court. This is a class action covering charges on Southwestern Bell Telephone bills.
Let's talk about this assignment and whether or not that's a good assignment or not to sustain this class action.
I think it is not a good assignment, Your Honor, and there are three ways that you could say that it's not a good assignment. You could simply say, and probably the simplest route for you to take, is to say that the assignment, the S&E, does not meet the requirements of Rule 42. In other words, the stepping in the shoes doesn't get it done in this case. The Amalgamated Union case, which we provided the court on Tuesday, was decided 3 weeks ago, probably has the most lucid discussion of that, which is very simple. Assignments transfer property. The right to be a class action representative is not property, and therefore it doesn't transfer with the assignment itself. As a result, an assignee must independently meet the requirements of Rule 42. In this case, STA cannot do that. It was never a member of the class. It did not suffer the class injury. Therefore, its claims are not typical, and therefore it's inadequate.
Under that theory, it's just because it's a class action. If they just brought it as a signee for 7,000 claims, that'd be okay.
I would say, as a generic proposition, Your Honor, an S&E can be, number one, could have a good claim and probably could serve as a class representative. I would say, however, that I think this particular assignment is void as a matter of public policy, because when you look at the record, I think you will find it quite clear that the assignment was taken for no reason other than to confer class representative status on someone who is not a member of the class. There's been some very dramatic testimony recently, news reporting, about people paying people, others, to be class representatives. If you look at the entirety of this assignment, what it is a conveyance of the claim and then a reconveyance by SDA of 70% of the claim back to the actual owner. So what is that other than simply a payment to SDA to serve as a class representative, which has the vice, number one, of proliferating litigation, two, but it hides the real parties in interest in the case. So to answer your question, I would say that, yes, an S&E can pursue these claims and could even be a class member, but I do think that this particular assignment is void as a matter of public policy.
Why is that such against public policy if, as you said, the ultimate consumer is going to get 70% of whatever is recovered and in a payment other than coupons, as I understand it? That seems to be...
I don't have any problem with the concept of assignments. What I have is a problem with using assignments to create standing to represent a class. I have a list of 10 vices as a result of that assignment. I'll just get started with
them. Send it in to Letterman.
And this comes by and large from Justice Brister and Justice Hecht in PPG and Gandy. They result in a commercial trading of claims, which proliferates litigation. It distorts the litigation through role reversal. SDA should not be in here contending that our folks were improperly charged. SDA pays municipal charges. It ought to be contending that everybody, in other words, there should be as broad a pool as possible. Number three, it essentially pays a stranger to be a class representative, I have said. It disrupts the usual market forces, as Mr. Justice Brister held in Tracker Marine. The fish just weren't biting in this case. That's why the assignments had to be solicited. It introduces a new area of concern, and that is the negotiations between the S&R and the S&E. It's, as the court well knows and has written, The class representative has tremendous fiduciary duties that it owes both to the class and to the court. In the negotiations between Assinore and Assinee to be a class representative, you now introduce a whole level of inquiry, an additional inquiry that I don't think needs to be burdened on top of those that are already there. And I think that was the concern that Mr. Justice Brister had also in the PPG case. It shields the attributes and characteristics of the real representative from scrutiny and control of the court. It extends litigation because a stranger assignee is disinclined to consider anything but a cash settlement. Why in the world would STA be interested in any sort of creative settlement that would enhance the services of the class members? Because it gets nothing unless cash is paid. Number eight, a third-party stranger increases the odds of conflicts and unique defenses. This case is a poster child for that. Number nine, it fosters a bias because the assignee, unlike a regular class member, can pick and choose which claims it wants to pursue. And it also can aggregate claims, which a normal class member cannot do. Number 10, it defeats the central purpose of class action, which is that individual claims are simply too small to litigate. So that's a long answer to your question, Your Honor, but that's why I think the assignment in this case.
Mr. Hatchell, isn't in large class suits the class representative a stranger in a lot of ways? It's not unusual for us to see cases where the class representative doesn't know the central gist of the claim. It's not familiar with what's really going on with the litigation. So is this so unusual from lots of other large classes?
But it may not be unusual, and that's one of my problems with class actions generally, but I think the rule itself has spoken to that. There is a reason why the rule starts off with requiring an adequate representative with a claim that is typical of the class, because there needs to be that identity. In reality, you and I both know it's not always true. But I don't know any other way to argue this case or to talk about class actions in general unless we hold to the ideals of the rule itself.
You also said that this allows, just on one of your points, the ability to pick and choose among claims or to aggregate claims. Didn't we recently say that the right or the ability to pick and choose claims is not per se inappropriate so long as, in doing so, the class rep does not prove itself inadequate or pick claims that are atypical of the rest of the class, and there are some other requirements too.
But I think per se that's true. In this particular case, the problem that you have is you have such a wide range of claims. We have one claim that theoretically is supposed to be $240,000. Most of the other claims are very, very small and can be, and there's a whole range of them. So the problem with the ability to pick and choose the large claims is that the assignee then is disinclined to favor or to consider options that might be available to the small claimants. It's a point. It's just one to me of a waterfall of problems that have come with this assignment.
What about the elements of the claim itself is different because of the assignment?
The elements of the claim itself would not be different, except to this extent. The ordinances do have an anti-assignment clause in them. And so when someone proceeds with one of these claims through an assignment, then you bring to bear whether or not the anti-assignment clause voids that. So that adds a different element. And that, by the way, is the third reason I think that the court should declare these assignments void.
If, apart from that reason, if this weren't a class and STA was just proceeding on its own as a signee of these claims, your position would be the same, that the assignment was invalid or shouldn't be against public policy?
Yeah, in other words, are you saying are they proceeding just to bring the claims?
Yes.
Again, I'll answer in the abstract. I don't think that there is any problem with pursuing one of these claims as an assignee, but I think when you look at this particular assignment, you will see that it really is not an assignment of the claim. it's a purported attempt to assign the right to be a class representative. That's very clear from the negotiations by which the assignments were entered into. But the answer to your question is yes. I am not contending that, as a general rule, assignments of these kinds of claims per se are void as a matter of law.
I presume you have the cases that were submitted to us this morning by Mr. Lloyd. I don't know if you had a chance to look at this urethane antitrust litigation, which Mr. Lloyd contends is on point with the issue that we have here and this assignment issue. Can you respond to that?
Both of those, actually one of those cases is actually in our favor. It finds it wasn't a class action, and it finds that there was no standing. Frankly, both cases are simply in a posit. I think I would probably do better in writing the court a letter about those. I only got to read them yet, or actually got to read them last night. But the cases, I think, actually show how far the respondents are having to dig in this case to find any legitimacy for them. The one case talks about, actually finds there was no standing because there was no right to proceed, and then it just in passing talks about the False Claims Act, and which is a statutorily conferred right to bring a representative action. There is no statutorily conferred right to bring a claim as an assignee. No statutorily conferred right to be a class representative in this case. I think there is another very important issue that the court should consider, and that is the question of conflict of interest and its impact upon the class representative in this case. The court well knows the standards for adequacy, and one of those, most important, is the absence of antagonism, which is the plaintiff's burden. SDA has three serious conflicts in this case. Its victory for some of its class members means that some of the absent class members will have to pay more. As I've already mentioned, by reason of the nature of its assignment, it is only interested in a cash settlement because that's the only way it profits. It cannot do coupons. It could not do any kind of creative service enhancements or anything of that nature, which, by the way, Southwestern Bell has done in the past. And third, it has no assignment from a hotel motel group, so it is disinclined to represent their interests vigorously at all. These conflicts are not disputed. What seems to be the issue is to whether or not they are, quote, speculative, and then whether or not they are, quote, potential. And I think there's a difference between speculative and potential. These conflicts are real. But the Court of Appeals said that, they're just potential, and the court can take care of all of this during the midst of trial. I think the higher standard and the higher road that this court should take is the one that says that the presence of even a potential conflict of interest is a disabling conflict that should prevent the class representative from serving. That said, Your Honor, I'm happy to entertain any other questions.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor. The court is ready to hear arguments from the respondent.
It please the court, Mr. Lloyd will present.
May it please the court, I bring before you a class action that is more suitable for class action status than any other class action I have seen. The defendant is one company. The class consists of the customers of one company. The liability and damages can be determined by examining the records of one company and the legal relationships between the members of the class and the defendant determined by the laws of one state, to wit, Texas. In point of fact,
but all that could happen. All that could happen if the company itself was not the class representative. I mean, the client of the company could be the class representative and still get the same benefits of having the same company present all the evidence.
Sure, the law applies equally to all parties. Yes, Your Honor.
So I guess what I'm saying is the economy that your argument puts forth wouldn't be precluded by an individual, by the client of the company bringing the being a class representative.
Certainly not. we have brought before a class representative that is uniquely qualified. And this, in fact, this is a uniquely qualified class action because it's in a regulated industry. There are basically no individual issues in this case. All the terms are defined, and all the relationships and legal responsibilities, rights, and privileges of the parties are defined by law. There's no individual issues of contract formation, as there was in Adcox. There's no questions that have to be gone that refer to prepare to individual issues. These issues are determined as a matter of law by examination of the law by the courts, determined as a matter of law, and apply equally to all parties, all members of the class, as well as the defendants.
Mr. Hetzel made an argument that this should be against public policy. What's your response to that?
This
type of assignment.
All right. This case was started from the get-go on the basis that an assignee cannot be a class rep. That's the way it was litigated by Southwest Nobel until their most recent reply brief, when they said on page 6 that Southwestern Bell does not maintain that a class rep can never be an assignee. This is news to me. It was news to me when I read that. So we've taken one issue out of the case. We've taken the issue out of the case that because of the status of an assignee, because of the status of a class rep is a class rep by assignment, that's by itself does not disqualify a party from being a class rep. Because you're in the class because you're an assignee, that does not disqualify you from being a class rep. That issue's gone. So what are we left with? We are left with analyzing the typicality and suitability of the class rep with a rigorous analysis, the same analysis that every class rep must undergo. Now, Mr. Hatchell has raised the issue that there's something wrong with this assignment. He is trying to create a new class of assignee, a stranger assignee, entrepreneurial assignee. These are words never heard before in the jurisprudence of the United States of America, which, except for a brief period in the 1860s, has always included Texas. Now, the reason why, the facts of the case don't support their argument. It's a matter of law, it's a matter of fact, and we know that the suitability of a class rep is determined on a case-by-case basis, but it's a fact question that's determined on a case-by-case analysis of the facts of the case. In this instance, far from being a stranger to this litigation, STA was intimately involved in this litigation from the beginning. One, they're well known to Southwestern Bell because their job is to audit the bills of Southwestern Bells, mostly for business customers in the state of Texas. Two, they were a member of the Morales class action along with all of the other users of Southwestern Bell services in the state of Texas. In point of fact, this class action was created as a result of a Rule 11 agreement entered into between STA and Southwestern Bell, wherein the claims of the business customers were carved out of the Morales cause of action during the fairness hearing.
If STA were more of a stranger, would you say that that might impact on the class certification or not? If it was like Acme class actions, and we hire out to take assignments and bring class actions, would that be problematic in your view?
It certainly would, Judge, which is certainly not supporting the facts of this case. Now,
and then the petitioner argues that this is not unlike paying somebody to be a class representative, a la the Milberg Weiss problems. What's your view of that?
Once we get past the concept that a class rep, that an assignee can be a class rep, once we get past that concept, which we have gotten past that concept, I believe, based on their concessions and, of course, all the cases that I brought, which I think maybe has something to do with their concessions in this case. But once we get past that concept that an assignee can be a class rep, then we repair to the rigorous analysis of their suitability and typicality to be a class rep, which is the standard in every case. I brought to you cases where assignees had been disqualified as class reps by virtue of an examination of their motives, how they acquired the assignments. Smith v. Ayers case from the Fifth Circuit. The class rep was denied class representative status. He had an assignment of one share of stock. He brought a shareholder derivative lawsuit. The court said you cannot do that because this is merely a strike suit in disguise. You cannot have ulterior motives behind bringing this lawsuit. Inway American Medical Systems.
But aren't derivative lawsuits a little different analysis? Are they the same analysis of class action?
Sure.
Derivative lawsuits? Aren't derivative lawsuits against a corporation, aren't they a little different?
This was under Rule 23. It was an analysis of Rule 23, and as we know, the Rule 42, our Rule 42, is a copy of Rule 23, and federal cases are instructive to us in these instances. And it stands for the proposition that the motives, the purposes, the reasons why assignments were acquired can be examined and would meet these issues. In other words, since we got past the idea that class reps can be assignees, then we just have to rigorously analyze their adequacy.
Okay, that's so adequacy on their on their adequacy, STA's objectives differ from the absent class members because the assignments favor or disfavor non-cash remedies. Isn't that correct here? Most of the members would derive value from a settlement paid in coupons or credits, but there was a Mr. Wilder, an STA employee, said coupon credit option was not even under consideration.
In point of fact, Judge, there's nothing in the record that supports any of those statements. In point of fact, Mr. Wilder did say he didn't think a coupon would be applicable in this case, and so did the Supreme Court in Bloyd. Let's go read Bloyd.
You said nothing supports any of those statements, so is it not correct that STA would disfavor non-cash remedies?
That is true, Judge. There's nothing in the record that supports that statement. In point of fact, they have added the
Did Mr. Wilder say that a coupon credit option was not under consideration?
He said it might not be suitable in this case, Judge. Now, the point is that they expanded that in their briefing to say he said the coupon settlements, refunds, other services wouldn't be considered. And the point of fact is there refunds on future bills, cash, additional services, those are all cash remedies because a value is attached to these services, and that is a monetary relief. So if there's some skepticism on the part of STA by virtue of a skepticism with regard to coupon settlements, the STA is merely reflecting the skepticism that this court expressed about coupon settlements wherein the class gets coupons and the attorneys gets millions of dollars. That was expressed by this court in Bloyd. In point of fact, that's what happened to Morales. That's why the Southwestern STA went down there. The Morales cause of action was this same cause of action brought on behalf of all the customers in the state of Texas. It was settled on a Cypre settlement where the class received nothing, zero, and the attorneys got millions of dollars. The only reason that these business customers are here and have their cause of action still alive is because Southwest STA went down there and objected and got a Rule 11 agreement carving out these causes of action to bring them on behalf of the business customers of Southwestern Bell.
Also with regard to adequacy of the class rep, the argument has been made that there may be a conflict of interest or at least a lack of representation of hotel-motel customers because there's been no assignment of that class of potential plaintiffs.
Yes, Justice Rainwright. Thank you for bringing that up. We know that the inquiry, it's even said in these cases that class representatives don't have to be clones of every member of the class. That is to say, the class representative doesn't necessarily have to have all the claims that every class member has. There merely has to be a common nexus of law and fact between the claims brought on behalf of the class and the claims brought on behalf of the class, by the class representative, owned by the class representative. In this case, hotel-motel arises from the same statutory scheme, it applies to the same USOCs, the legal theories behind why the bills cannot be collected, why it's an improper collection, are the same legal theories that apply for the digital trunk and the smart trunk and the digital loop services. These are all phone services for businesses. These are large customers that have a lot of switching, a lot of telephones, a lot of lines. So they have these facts in common with the claims that Southwest Tariff Analysis has assigned to it, and they have the law in question. So there is a nexus of law and fact between the hotel-motel services and the smart trunk and digital loop. There has been no showing, only speculation, of any conflict in this case. Mr. Hatchell has raised all these horrible possibilities, and they are nothing but speculation. Each of the potential conflicts was dealt with by the court below, and there's record evidence in the record which meets each of these differences. He raised the issue of
why is the Amalgamated Transit case wrong?
Well, I have two things to say about the Amalgamated Transit case. One, it's a narrow interpretation of California statutory law of a right given under the California Labor Code Private Attorneys General Act to pursue causes of action on behalf of other members who are beneficiaries of the Labor Code. It's a narrow interpretation of California law. Two, it's wrong. Now, go read the dissent. dissent by the presiding judge has got, he says, I am unable to locate any authority which compels these conclusions urged by the majority, nor does there seem to be a compelling policy or other reason to reach the result. It's wrong. I don't even think it's California law. It flies in the face of jurisprudence all across the country and in California, as the presiding judge points out. So it's just wrong, Judge. I'm sorry. It's just wrong. But if you want to say it's right, well, it's based on a narrow interpretation of California statutory law. So that's my answer to it.
So STA would keep 30% of any recovery? Is that correct?
That's correct, Judge.
What about attorney's fees?
Attorney's fees, we'd hope to, we can get our attorney's fees from the aggregate settlement, the same as it is in every other class action. There's nothing to do different about it. Yes, sir.
So the class would get 70% of any recovery?
No. No, Judge. STA will keep 30% of the, as I understand it, of the proceeds from their five assignees. The class will keep 100% of anybody who's not assigned them will keep 100%.
100% of what?
Of their recovery.
But STA is getting 30%, right?
Of the five assignors that have assigned them causes of action.
I see. And the rest of the class gets 100%
of whatever. That's my understanding of the situation, Judge. We're not claiming that STA gets 30% of the aggregate settlement, if there is one. Reallocation. They just raised the issue of reallocation. These facts were all introduced through our expert, Mr. Clapsaddle, and that's his real name. Mr. Clapsaddle was our expert. He's a former employee of Southwestern Bell, who's been in this business for 30 years and never been subject to a Daubert challenge. I don't even know if I have to go any farther than that. He's an expert in computers and the billing practices of telecommunications industry, and he has been cited as an expert all across the country. And he was in this. He's been in the Southwestern Bell litigation since the City of Mesquite case in 1988. He knows more about their records and their billing practices and their computer system than they do. And it's apparent if you read the transcript that that's the fact. And they had to bring forward some issues that they raised through Mr. Clapsaddle because their own guy didn't know it. So what they said is, Mr. Clapsaddle, is there going to be a reallocation? Because the idea that some members, if they have a right to recoup these, Southwestern Bell has a right to recoup some of their franchise fees from their customer base because of the tariff, and that may mean the reallocation may jigger it around. Well, that's from them. We don't think there's going to be a reallocation as a matter of law. We say that Southwestern Bell is bound by the tariff, which says they have a six-month period in which they can recover any underbilling. So we think the six-month period is long past. So we, as STA, believes and takes the position that there will be no reallocation. But Mr. Clapsaddle is prepared to deal with reallocation. Why? Because we know to have a good class, to have a good trial plan, we have to be prepared to deal with any contingencies that may arise. And he was ready to deal with it. The reallocation, if there is any, which we don't think there will be a minimal impact upon not the interest of the class, but just merely their cash recoveries. This scheme of recovering franchise fees from the customer base extends to every Southwestern Bell customer in the state of Texas, 5 million of them. Any reallocation will be spread over 5 million and will have, as Mr. Clapsaddle said, a very small impact, if any, upon the interest of any of these business customers, which amount to about 6,900. By the way, the class has been identified. The Southwestern Bell submitted to the court a list of the potential class members, putative class members, and submitted to the court. There's about 6,900 of them. So we have a class that's already been identified.
Are there any other suits like this pending in Texas?
No, sir. Previous litigation has basically been on the franchise litigation is based on the cities claiming that they, you know, the allocation is not proper.
Some of those cases are still around. Is that right or not?
I don't think so, Judge. I think they're all resolved. SAC ordinances, specified annual payment ordinances, went out of existence in March of 2000. There was a brief interregnum where they used a fee per line to recover, and now it's done by statute. There's a statute that does this thing. So the SAP ordinances were in existence about just basically in the period of the 90s. Okay, the reallocation is de minimis. We don't think it'll happen. And point of fact, they act as if this is some kind of antagonism or some kind of conflict on the part of STA. Well, it's not. STA has no control over whether or not the court decides that the six-month period doesn't apply and that there can be a reallocation. It's a question of law for the court. STA doesn't control or make any kind of decision about that, about whether or not they're going to reallocate or not. This is going to be a – they're going to urge it, and we're going to say it doesn't apply. And if the court decides it applies, it's by operation of law. It's not a conflict or an antagonism, because it's something that's strictly inherent in the law as it applies to the situation in this litigation. And that is why this is such a dandy little class action, because everything is determined by the application of tariff, statute, and ordinance. I want to talk about that anti-assignability clause. Mr. Hatchell, in his briefing today, doesn't seem to understand exactly how these things work. There is a somewhat complex interaction here of ordinance, tariff, and statute that provides the legal matrix that regulates the relationship between the great monopoly of Southwestern Bell and its customers. It's a regulated industry for a purpose. Ordinances are, in effect, the contract between the city and the utility, the Southwestern Bell. Southwestern Bell, the utility says, Southwestern Bell, you can come in and use our rights of way, but you have to pay us a fee for it. And it's been called a rent. It's not a tax, it's a rent. And this ordinance says you may recover from our customer base, who are our citizens, your customer base, who are our citizens, recoupment under certain conditions of this, according to tariff. Take a look. Every one of these ordinances has in that recoupment paragraph, comma, according to tariff, comma. That is because the PURA, the Public Utility Regulatory Act, Section 53.002, says that no utility, no telephone company can recover anything from its customers unless it's by tariff, unless it's in a tariff. Now, the tariff, Section 23, paragraph 11, specifically says, Southwestern Bell, you may recover franchise fees, taxes that are levied by municipalities upon your gross receipts by a line item in your bills. That is what gives them the authority. That is what gives them the Southwestern Bell the authority to take money from their customers. So the ordinance is, which controls the relationship between the city and the utility, is looked to determine the standard. What have they gotten permission to take from their customers as way of compensation for franchise fees? We look to the tariff for the authority. Without the tariff, Southwestern Bell would have no authority to take this money from their customers. And it's very clear. Well, what I've got here is a class. It's in a regulated industry where everybody's rights and privileges are determined by law, where it's uniform across the board. I've got a class representative that's been rigorously analyzed, that's every nook, cranny, and crevice of these assignments was looked at. All the president of STA is here. He was deposed. Mr. Wilder was deposed. All the assigners were deposed. Every aspect of this litigation has been looked at very carefully. A rigorous analysis of their suitability to be a class rep has been carried out. The courts of appeal applied the proper standards in reviewing that rigorous analysis and applied their own rigorous analysis. Under current laws that exist in the state of Texas, this is a good class action. This is a good class rep. Any other questions, Your Honor?
Thank you, Mr. Lloyd.
Thank you.
Please, the court. Justice Medina, the urethane case which was cited was a situation where the assignee was actually the same claim. What happened was, in the midst of the litigation, the business was sold. And so the claim passed on to the party who ultimately was aggrieved by assignment. But it was brought by the person who was a member of the class and who had suffered the injury. The Glanton case was a case where actually the court held that a party could not sue an ERISA fiduciary unless it had suffered any injury. And in that particular case, they held they had not suffered any injury. So, and The only reason that case is cited is because of a bare reference to the False Claims Act, which is a statutorily assigned. So those cases have absolutely nothing to do with this case. I think what the court has heard this morning is a very simple construct of this case. An assignee steps into the shoes of the assignor, and by stepping into the shoes, you automatically become entitled to be a class representative. There are two problems with that. First of all, it commercializes the right to be a class representative. Under their theory, they could take their assignments and put their right to be class representative on eBay, and anybody could bid on that that wanted to. The second problem is that it asks the court to just simply disregard the nature of the assignment itself and what violence that does to the particular elements of Rule 42. Justice Hecht, I recall in, I believe it was in Gandy, you made a very interesting point about Trevino versus Turcotte, the infamous Sarita East. And the point there was, yes, assignments of rights to an estate are freely assignable, and this court does not want to do any violence to that. But when you look at this particular assignment, what you're trying to do is to wire around the fact that you accepted benefits under the 1960 will, and yet you're taking assignments in order to defeat the estoppel which the law imposes against you. And I simply say that this court should look very closely at the assignments in this case, and when you do, I think you will find that they are terribly destructive of the class process. Insofar as the conflict of interest is concerned, an area where I think this court should write, the only argument I heard was, well, we don't think it will happen. That's certify now, worry later. It's there, and it needs to be dealt with, and we think it's disabling.
But you also said that if it did happen, it would be because an operation of law, and not for any other reason. Because there's a judge that's going to have to make a decision based on what that law is as it applies to this class.
Well, I think that the problem with the conflict is how it's not whether or not it's going to be resolved, because I think he's talking about the reallocation would be determined as a matter of law, and I don't know whether I agree or disagree with that. The problem is not how a reallocation occurs. It is whether or not this particular class representative, by not having a claim for the hotel motel group, is disinclined to represent them, and two, because it is only interested in a cash outlay, whether or not it's going to pursue options. How the law handles the ultimate disposition of the damages is really not the issue. It's the disablement on the class representative himself and how that impacts how the class representative will handle it. And we think the conflicts are clearly there. They're admitted in the record. Their expert admitted that they were there, and they just said, we can fix it. We can fix it.
Does it matter if it's a cash outlay, as you say, or some type of other recovery? Because as I understood Mr. Lloyd's argument, that the testimony that coupons weren't appropriate for this type of, or this particular litigation, not that coupons have been ruled out. We'll look at the record.
In the letter that I give you on the cases, I will actually attach the testimony. He said two things, as I recall. They're not under consideration, and two, he thought a coupon settlement was illegal. So that speaks to me volumes about the adequacy itself of these class representatives. Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Hatchell. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.